Pastoral Care by St. Gregory the Great. Part 3, Prologue. How the ruler, while living well, ought to teach and admonish those that are put under him. Since then we have shown what manner of man the pastor ought to be, let us now set forth after what manner he should teach. For as long before us Gregory Nazianzen of reverend memory has taught, one and the same exhortation does not suit all, inasmuch as neither are all bound together by similarity of character. For the things that profit some often hurt others, seeing that also for the most part herbs which nourish some animals are fatal to others, and the gentle hissing that quiets horses excites puppies, and the medicine which abates one disease aggravates another, and the bread which invigorates the life of the strong kills little children. Therefore, according to the quality of the hearers, ought the discourse of teachers to be fashioned, so as to suit all and each for their several needs, and yet never deviate from the art of common edification. For what are the intent minds of hearers, but, so to speak, a kind of tight tension of strings in a harp, which the skillful player, that he may produce a tune not at variance from itself, strikes in various ways. And for this reason the strings render back a consonant modulation, that they are struck indeed with one quill, but not with one kind of stroke. Whence every teacher also, that he may edify all in the one virtue of charity, ought to touch the hearts of his hearers out of one doctrine, but not with one and the same exhortation. Chapter 1. What diversity there ought to be in the art of preaching. Differently to be admonished are these that follow: men and women, the poor and the rich, the joyful and the sad, prelates and subordinates, servants and masters, the wise of this world and the dull, the impudent and the bashful, the forward and the faint-hearted, the impatient and the patient, the kindly disposed and the envious, the simple and the insincere, the healthy and the sick, those who fear scourges and therefore live innocently, and those who have grown so hard in iniquity as not to be corrected even by scourges, the too silent, and those who spend time in much speaking, the slothful and the hasty, the meek and the passionate, the humble and the haughty, the obstinate and the fickle, the gluttonous and the abstinent, those who mercifully give of their own, and those who would like to seize what belongs to others, those who neither seize the things of others nor are bountiful with their own, and those who both give away the things they have and yet cease not to seize the things of others, those that are at variance and those that are at peace, lovers of strife and peacemakers, those that do not understand aright the words of sacred law, and those who indeed understand them aright but speak them without humility, those who, though able to preach worthily, are afraid through excessive humility, and those whom imperfection or age debar from preaching, and yet rashness impels them to it, those who prosper in what they desire in temporal matters, and those who indeed covet the things that are of this world, and yet are wearied with the toils of adversity, those who are bound by wedlock, and those who are free from the ties of wedlock, those who have had experience of carnal intercourse, and those who are ignorant of it, those who deplore sins of deed, and those who deplore sins of thought, those who bewail misdeeds, yet forsake them not, and those who forsake them, yet bewail them not, those who even praise the unlawful things they do, and those who censure what is wrong and yet do not avoid it, those who are overcome by sudden passion, and those who are bound in guilt by set purpose. Those who, though their unlawful deeds are trivial, do them frequently, and those who keep themselves from small sins, but are occasionally whelmed in graver ones. Those who do not even begin what is good, and those who fail entirely to complete the good begun. Those who do evil secretly and good publicly, and those who conceal the good they do, and yet in some things, done publicly, allow evil to be thought of them. But of what profit is it for us to run through all these things collected together in a list, unless we also set forth, with all possible brevity, the modes of admonition for each? Differently, then, are to be admonished are men and women, because on men, heavier injunctions, on the latter, lighter, are to be laid, that those may be exercised by great things, but these winningly converted by light ones. Differently to be admonished are young men and old, because, for the most part, severity of admonition directs the young to improvement, while kind remonstrance disposes the latter to better deeds. For it is written, "Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father." Chapter 2. How the Poor and Rich Should Be Admonished. Differently to be admonished are the poor and the rich. For to the poor we ought to offer the solace of comfort against tribulation, but to the rich to induce fear as against elation. For to the poor one it is said by the Lord through the prophet, "Fear not, for thou shalt not be confounded." And not long after, soothing her, he says, "O thou poor little one, tossed with tempest." And again he comforts her, saying, "I have chosen thee in the furnace of poverty." But on the other hand, Paul says to his disciple concerning the rich, "Charge the rich of this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in the uncertainty of their riches." Where it is to be particularly noted that the teacher of humility, in making mention of the rich, says not entreat, but charge. Because though pity is to be bestowed on infirmity, yet to elation no honor is due. To such, therefore, the right thing that is said is the more rightly commanded, according as they are puffed up with loftiness of thought in transitory things. Of them the Lord says in the gospel, "Woe unto you that are rich, for you have your consolation." For since they know not what the eternal joys are, they are consoled out of the abundance of the present life. Therefore, consolation is to be offered to those who are tried in the furnace of poverty, and fear is to be induced in those whom the consolation of temporal glory lifts up, that both those may learn that they possess riches which they see not, and these become aware that they can by no means keep the riches that they see. Yet, for the most part, the character of persons changes the order in which they stand, so that the rich man may be humble and the poor man proud. Hence the tongue of the preacher ought soon to be adapted to the life of the hearer, so as to smite elation in a poor man all the more sharply, as not even the poverty that has come upon him brings it down, and to cheer all the more gently the humility of the rich, as even the abundance which elevates them does not elate them. Sometimes, however, even a proud rich man is to be propitiated by blandishment in exhortation, since hard sores also are usually softened by soothing fomentations, and the rage of the insane is often restored to health by the bland words of the physician. And when they are pleasantly humored, the disease of their insanity is mitigated. For neither is this to be lightly regarded, that when an adverse spirit entered into Saul, David took his harp and assuaged his madness. For what is intimated by Saul but the elation of men in power? And what by David but the humble life of the holy? When, then, Saul is seized by the unclean spirit, his madness is appeased by David's singing. Since when the senses of men in power are turned to frenzy by elation, it is fitting that they should be recalled to a healthy state by the calmness of our speech, as by the sweetness of a harp. But sometimes, when the powerful of this world are taken to task, they are first to be searched by certain likenesses, as on a matter not concerning them. And when they have pronounced a right sentence as against another man, then, in fitting ways, they are to be hit with regard to their own guilt, so that the mind puffed up with temporal power may in no wise lift itself up against the reprover, having by its own judgment trodden on the neck of pride, and may not try to defend itself, being bound by the sentence of its own mouth. For hence it was that Nathan the prophet, having come to take the king to task, asked his judgment as if concerning the cause of a poor man against a rich one, that the king might first pronounce sentence, and afterwards hear of his own guilt, to the end that he might by no means contradict the righteous doom that he had uttered against himself. Thus the holy man, considering both the sinner and the king, studied in a wonderful order first to bind the daring culprit by confession, and afterwards to cut him to the heart by rebuke. He concealed for a while who he aimed at, but smote him suddenly when he had him. For the blow would perchance have fallen with less force, had he purposed to smite the sin openly from the beginning of his discourse. But by first introducing the likeness, he sharpened the rebuke which he concealed. He had come like a physician to a sick man. He saw that the sore must be cut open, but he doubted of the sick man's patience. Therefore he hid the medicinal steel under his robe, which he suddenly drew out and plunged into the sore, that the patient might feel the cutting blade before he saw it, lest, seeing it first, he should refuse to feel it. End of chapter 2. Pastoral Care by St. Gregory the Great. Part 3, Chapter 3. How the joyful and sad are to be admonished. Differently to be admonished are the joyful and the sad. That is, before the joyful are to be set the sad things that follow upon punishment, but before the sad, the promised glad things of the kingdom. Let the joyful learn by the asperity of threats what to be afraid of. Let the sad bear what joys of reward they may look forward to. For to the former it is said, "Woe unto you that laugh now, for you shall weep." But the latter hear from the teaching of the same master, "I will see you again, and your heart will rejoice, and your joy no man shall take from you." But some are not made joyful or sad by circumstances, but are so by temperament. And to such it should be intimated that certain defects are connected with certain temperaments, that the joyful have lechery close at hand, and the sad, wrath. Hence it is necessary for every one to consider not only what he suffers from his peculiar temperament, but also what worse thing presses on him in connection with it, lest while he fights not at all against that which he has, he succumb also to that from which he supposes himself free. Chapter 4. How Subjects and Prelates are to be admonished. Differently to be admonished are subjects and prelates. The former, that subjection crush them not. The latter, that a superior place elate them not. The former, that they fail not to fulfill what is commanded of them. the latter that they command not more to be fulfilled than is just, the former that they submit humbly, the latter that they preside temperately. For this, which may be understood also figuratively, is said to the former, Children, obey your parents in the Lord. But to the latter it is enjoined, And you, fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Let the former learn how to order their inward thoughts before the eyes of the hidden judge. The latter, how also to those that are committed to them to afford outward examples of good living. For prelates ought to know that if they ever perpetrate what is wrong, they are worthy of as many deaths as they transmit examples of perdition to their subjects. Wherefore it is necessary that they guard themselves so much the more cautiously from sin, as by the bad things they do, they die not alone, but are guilty of the souls of others, which by their bad example they have destroyed. Wherefore, the subjects are to be admonished, lest they should be strictly published, if merely on their own account, they should be unable to stand acquitted. The prelates, lest they should be judged for the errors of their subjects, even though on their own account they find themselves secure. Subjects are to be admonished that they live with all the more anxiety about themselves, as they are not entangled by care for others. But prelates, that they accomplish their charge of others in such a way as not to desist from charge of themselves, and so to be ardent in anxiety about themselves as not to grow sluggish in the custody of those committed to them. To the subject who is at leisure for his own concerns, it is said, Go to the ant, thou sluggard, and consider her ways, and learn wisdom. But the prelate is terribly admonished, when it is said, My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger, and art snared with the words of thy mouth, and art taken with thine own speeches. For to be surety for a friend is to take charge of the soul of another, on the surety of one's own behavior. Whence also the hand is stricken with a stranger? Because the mind is bound with the care of a responsibility which before was not. But he is snared with the words of his mouth and taken with his own speeches. Because while he is compelled to speak good things to those who are committed to him, he must needs himself, in the first place, observe the things that he speaks. He is therefore snared with the words of his mouth, being constrained by the requirement of reason not to let his life be relaxed to what agrees not with his teaching. Hence, before the strict judge, he is compelled to accomplish as much in deed as it is plain he has enjoined on others with his voice. Thus, in the passage above cited, this exhortation is also presently added. Do therefore what I say, my son, and deliver thyself, seeing thou hast fallen into the hands of thy neighbor. Run up and down, hasten, arouse thy friend, give not sleep to thine eyes, nor let thine eyelids slumber. For whosoever is put over others for an example of life is admonished not only to keep watch himself, but also to wake his friend. For it is not enough for him to keep watch in living well, if he do not also sever him whom he is set over, from the torpor of sin. For it is well said, Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor let thine eyelids slumber. For indeed, to give sleep to the eyes is to cease from earnestness, so as to neglect altogether the care of our subordinates. But the eyelids slumber, when our thoughts, weighed down by sloth, connive at what they know ought to be reproved in subordinates. For to be fast asleep is neither to know nor to correct the deeds of those committed to us, but to know what things are to be blamed and still, through laziness of mind, not amend them by fitting rebukes, is not to sleep, but to slumber. Yet the eye, through slumbering, passes into the deepest sleep, since, for the most part, when one who is over others does not cut off the evil that he knows, he comes sooner or later, as his negligence deserves, not even to know what is done wrong by his subjects. Wherefore, those who are over others are to be admonished, that through earnestness of circumspection they have eyes watchful within and round about, and strive to become living creatures of heaven. For the living creatures of heaven are described as full of eyes round about and within. And so it is fitting that those who are over others should have eyes within and round about, so as both in themselves to study to please the inward judge, and also affording outwardly examples of life, to detect the things that should be corrected in others. Subjects are to be admonished that they judge not rashly the lives of their superiors, if perchance they see them act blamably in anything, lest, from where they rightly find fault with evil, they there thence be sunk by the impulse of elation to lower depths. They are to be admonished that when they consider the faults of their superiors, they grow not too bold against them, but if any of their deeds are exceedingly bad, so judge of them within themselves that, constrained by the fear of God, they still do not refuse to bear the yoke of reverence under them. Which thing we shall show the better, if we bring forward what David did. For when Saul, the persecutor, had entered into a cave to ease himself, David, who had so long suffered under his persecution, was within it with his men. And when his men incited him to smite Saul, he cut them short with the reply that he ought not to put forth his hand against the Lord's anointed. And yet, he rose unperceived and cut off the border of his robe. For what is signified by Saul but bad rulers, and what by David but good subjects? Saul's easing himself, then, means rulers extending the wickedness conceived in their hearts to works of woeful stench, and their showing the noisome thoughts within them by carrying them out into deeds. Yet David was afraid to strike him, because the pious minds of subjects, withholding themselves from the whole plague of backbiting, smite the life of their superiors with no sword of the tongue, even when they blame them for imperfection. And when through infirmity they can scarce refrain from speaking, however humbly, of some extreme and obvious evil of their superiors, they cut, as it were, silently, the border of their robe, because, to wit, when even though harmlessly and secretly they derogate from the dignity of superiors, they disfigure, as it were, the garment of the king who is set over them. Yet still they return to themselves and blame themselves most vehemently for even the slightest defamation of speech. Hence it is also well written in that place, afterward David's heart smote him, because he had cut off the border of Saul's robe. For indeed, the deeds of superior are not to be smitten with the sword of the mouth, even when they are rightly judged to be worthy of blame. But if ever, even in the least, the tongue slips into censure of them, the heart must needs be depressed by the affliction of penitence, to the end that it may return to itself, and when it has offended against the power set over it, may dread the judgment against itself of him by whom it was set over it. For when we offend against those who are set over us, we go against the ordinance of him who set them over us. Whence also Moses, when he had become aware that the people complained against himself and Aaron, he said, "For what are we? Not against us are your murmurings, but against the Lord." End of chapter 4. Pastoral Care by St. Gregory the Great. Part 3, Chapter 5. How Servants and Masters Are to Be Admonished. Differently to be admonished are servants and masters. servants, to wit, that they ever keep in view the humility of their condition, but masters, that they do not lose the recollection of their nature, in which they are constituted on an equality with servants. Servants are to be admonished that they despise not their masters, lest they offend God, if by behaving themselves proudly they gainsay God's ordinance. Masters, too, are to be admonished that they are proud against God with respect to his gift, if they acknowledge not those whom they hold in subjection by reason of their condition, to be their equals by reason of their community of nature. The former are to be admonished to know themselves to be servants of masters. The latter are to be admonished to acknowledge themselves to be fellow servants of servants. For to servants it is said, "Servants, obey your masters according to the flesh." And again, "Let as many servants as are under the yoke count their masters worthy of all honor." But to masters it is said, "And you, masters, do the same things to them, forbearing threats, knowing that both their and your master is in heaven." Chapter 6. How the Wise and the Dull are to be admonished. Differently to be admonished are the wise of this world and the dull. For the wise are to be admonished that they leave off knowing what they know. The dull also are to be admonished that they seek to know what they do not. In the former, this thing first, that they think themselves wise, is to be thrown down. In the latter, anything whatsoever is already known of heavenly wisdom is to be built up. Since being in no wise proud, the dull have, as it were, prepared their hearts for supporting a building. With the wise we should labor that they become more wisely foolish, leaving foolish wisdom, and learn the wise foolishness of God. To the dull we should preach that from what is accounted foolishness they should pass, as from a nearer neighborhood, to true wisdom. For to the wise it is said, "If any man among you seems to be wise in this world, let him become a fool, that he may be wise." But to the dull it is said, "Not many wise men after the flesh." And again, "God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise." The wise are, for the most part, converted by arguments of reasoning, the latter sometimes better by examples. The wise it doubtless profits to lie vanquished in their own allegations. But for the dull, it is sometimes enough to get knowledge of the praiseworthy deeds of others. Whence also the excellent teacher, who was debtor to the wise and foolish, when he was admonishing some of the Hebrews that were wise, but some also that were somewhat slow, speaking to them of the fulfillment of the Old Testament, overcame the wisdom of the wise by argument, saying, "That which decays and waxes old is ready to vanish away." But when he perceived that some were to be drawn by examples only, he added in the same epistle, "Saints had trial of mockings and scourgings, yea, moreover of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn apart, were tempted, were slain with the sword." And again, "Remember those who were set over you, who spoke to you the word of God, whose faith follow, looking to the end of their conversation." That so victorious reason might subdue the one sort, but the gentle force of example persuade the other to mount to greater things. Chapter 7. How the Impudent and Bashful are to be admonished. Differently to be admonished are the impudent and the bashful. For those, nothing but hard rebuke restrains from the vice of impudence, while these, for the most part, a modest exhortation disposes to amendment. The impudent do not know that they are at fault unless they be rebuked even by many. To the bashful it usually suffices for their conversion that the teacher at least gently reminds them of their evil deeds. For the impudent, one best corrects who reprehends them by direct invective. But to the bashful, greater profit ensues if what is rebuked in them be touched, as it were, by a side stroke. Thus the Lord, openly upbraiding the impudent people of the Jews, saying, "There is come unto thee a whore's forehead, you would not blush." But again, God revives them when ashamed, saying, "You shall forget the confusion of your youth, and shall not remember the reproach of your widowhood, for thy Maker will reign over thee." Paul also openly upbraids the Galatians impudently sinning, when he says, "O foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you?" And again, "Are you so foolish that having begun in the Spirit, you are now made perfect in the flesh?" But the faults of those who are ashamed, he reprehends as though sympathizing with them, saying, "I rejoiced in the Lord greatly, that now at the last you have flourished again to care for me, as indeed you did care, for you lacked opportunity." So that hard upbraiding might discover the faults of the former, and a softer address veil the negligence of the latter. End of chapter 7. Pastoral Care by St. Gregory the Great. Book 3, Chapter 8. How the Forward and Faint-Hearted Are to Be Admonished. Differently to be admonished are the forward and the faint-hearted. For the former, presuming on themselves too much, disdain all others when reproved by them. But the latter, while too conscious of their own infirmity, for the most part, fall into despondency. The forward count all they do to be singularly eminent. The faint-hearted think what they do to be exceedingly despised, and so are broken down to despondency. Therefore, the works of the forward are to be finely sifted by the reprover, that wherein they please themselves, they may be shown to displease God. For we then best correct the forward when what they believe themselves to have done well, we show to have been ill done, that from whence glory is believed to have been gained, thence wholesome confusion may ensue. But sometimes, when they are not at all aware of being guilty of the vice of forwardness, they more speedily come to correction if they are confounded by the infamy of some other person's more manifest guilt, sought out from a side quarter, that from that which they cannot defend, they may be made conscious of wrongly holding to what they do defend. Whence, when Paul saw the Corinthians to be forwardly puffed up one against another, so that one said he was of Paul, another of Apollos, another of Cephas, and another of Christ, he brought forward the crime of incest, which had not only been perpetrated among them, but also remained uncorrected, saying, "It is reported commonly that there is fornication among you, and such fornication as is not even among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife. And you are puffed up, and have not rather mourned that he that has done this deed might be taken away from among you?" As if to say plainly, "Why do you say in your forwardness that you are of this one or of the other, while showing in the dissoluteness of your negligence that you are of none of them?" But, on the other hand, we more fitly bring back the faint-hearted to the way of well-doing if we search collaterally for some good points about them, so that while some things in them we attack with our reproof, others we may embrace with our praise, to the end that the hearing of praise may nourish their tenderness, which the rebuking of their fault chastises. And for the most part we make more way with them for their profit, if we also make mention of their good deeds. And in case of some wrong things having been done by them, if we find not fault with them as though they were already perpetrated, but, as it were, prohibit them as what ought not to be perpetrated, that so both the favor shown may increase the things which we approve, and our modest exhortation avail more with the faint-hearted against the things which we blame. Whence the same Paul, when he came to know that the Thessalonians, who stood fast in the preaching which they had received, were troubled with a certain faint-heartedness, as though the end of the world were nigh at hand, first praises that wherein he sees them to be strong, and afterwards, with cautious admonition, strengthens what was weak. For he says, "We are bound to thank God always for you, brethren, as it is meet, because that your faith grows exceedingly, and the charity of every one of you all towards each other abounds, so that we ourselves too glory in you in the churches of God for your patience and faith." But having premised these flattering encomiums of their life, a little while after he subjoined, "Now we beseech you, brethren, by the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, and our gathering together unto him, that you be not soon shaken in mind, or be troubled, neither by spirit nor by word, nor by letter sent by us, as that the day of the Lord is at hand." For the true teacher so proceeded that they should first hear, in being praised, what they might thankfully acknowledge, and afterwards, in being exhorted, what they should follow, to the end that the precedent praise should settle their mind, lest the subjoined admonition should shake it. And though he knew that they had been disquieted by suspicion of the end being near, he did not yet reprove them as having been so, but, as if ignorant of the past, forbade them to be disquieted in future, so that while they believed themselves to be unknown to their preacher with respect even to the levity of their disquietude, they might be as much afraid of being open to blame as they were of being known by him to be so. Chapter 9. How the Impatient and the Patient Are to Be Admonished. Differently to be admonished are the impatient and the patient. For the impatient are to be told that while they neglect to bridle their spirit, they are hurried through many steep places of iniquity which they seek not after, inasmuch as fury drives the mind whither desire draws it not. And when perturbed, it does, not knowing, what it afterwards grieves for when it knows. The impatient are also to be told that when carried headlong by the impulse of emotion, they act in some ways as though beside themselves, and are hardly aware afterwards of the evil they have done. And while they offer no resistance to their perturbation, they bring into confusion even things that may have been well done when the mind was calm, and overthrow under sudden impulse whatever they have happily long built up with provident toil. For the very virtue of charity, which is the mother and guardian of all virtues, is lost through the vice of impatience. For it is written, "Charity is patient." Wherefore, where patience is not, charity is not. Through this vice of impatience, too, instruction, the nurse of virtues, is dissipated. For it is written, "The instruction of a man is known by his patience." Every man, then, is shown to be by so much less instructed as he is convicted of being less patient. For neither can he truly impart what is good through instruction, if in his life he knows not how to bear what is evil in others with equanimity. Further, through this vice of impatience, for the most part, the sin of arrogance pierces the mind, since when any one is impatient of being looked down upon in this world, he endeavors to show off any hidden good that he may have, and so, through impatience, is drawn on to arrogance. And while he cannot bear contempt, he glories ostentatiously in self-display. Whence it is written, "Better is the patient than the arrogant." Because in truth, one who is patient chooses to suffer any evils whatever, rather than that his hidden good should come to be known through the vice of ostentation. But the arrogant, on the contrary, chooses that even pretended good should be vaunted of him, lest he should possibly suffer even the least evil. Since then, when patience is relinquished, all other good things also that have been done are overthrown. It is rightly enjoined on Ezekiel that in the altar of God a trench be made, to wit, that in it the whole burnt offerings laid on the altar might be preserved. For if there were not a trench in the altar, the passing breeze would scatter every sacrifice that it might find there. But what do we take the altar of God to be, but the soul of the righteous man, which lays upon itself, before his eyes, as many sacrifices as it has done good deeds? And what is the trench of the altar, but the patience of good men, which, while it humbles the mind to endure adversities, shows it to be placed low down after the manner of a ditch? Wherefore, let a trench be made in the altar, lest the breeze should scatter the sacrifice laid upon it. That is, let the mind of the elect keep patience, lest stirred with the wind of impatience, it lose even that which it has wrought well. Well, too, this same trench is directed to be of one cubit, because if patience fails not, the measure of unity is preserved. Whence also Paul says, "Bear ye one another's burdens, and so ye shall fulfill the law of Christ." For the law of Christ is the charity of unity, which they alone fulfill who are guilty of no excess, even when they are burdened. Let the impatient hear what is written: "Better is the patient than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes cities." For victory over cities is a lesser thing, because that which is subdued is outside. But a far greater thing is that which is conquered by patience, since the mind itself is by itself overcome, and subjects itself to itself, when patience compels it to bridle itself within. Let the impatient hear what the truth says to his elect: "In your patience you shall possess your souls." For we are so wonderfully made that reason possesses the soul, and the soul the body. But the soul is ousted from its right of possession of the body, if it is not first possessed by reason. Therefore the Lord pointed out patience as the guardian of our state, in that he taught us to possess ourselves in it. Thus we learn how great is the sin of impatience, through which we lose the very possession of what we are. Let the impatient hear what is said again through Solomon: "A fool utters all his mind, but a wise man puts it off, and reserves it until afterward." For one who is so driven by the impulse of impatience as to utter forth the whole mind, which the perturbation within throws out the more quickly for this reason, that no discipline of wisdom fences it round. But the wise man puts it off, and reserves it till afterwards. For when injured, he desires not to avenge himself at the present time, because in his tolerance he even wishes that men should be spared. But yet he is not ignorant that all things are righteously avenged at the last judgment. On the other hand, the patient are to be admonished that they grieve not inwardly for what they bear outwardly, lest they spoil with the infection of malice within a sacrifice of so great value which without they offer whole. And lest the sin of their grieving, not perceived by men, but yet seen as sin under the divine scrutiny, be made so much the worse as it claims to itself the fair show of virtue before men. The patient, therefore, should be told to study to love those whom they must needs bear with, lest if love follow not patience, the virtue exhibited be turned to a worse fault of hatred. Whence Paul, when he said, "Charity is patient," forthwith added, "is kind," showing certainly that those whom in patience she bears with in kindness, also she ceases not to love. Whence the same excellent teacher, when he was persuading his disciples to patience, saying, "Let all bitterness and wrath and indignation and clamor and evil speaking be put away from you," having, as it were, now set all outward things in good order, turns himself to those that are within when he subjoins with all malice. Because truly, in vain are indignation, clamor, and evil speaking put away from the things that are without, if in the things that are within, malice, the mother of vices, bears sway. And to no purpose is wickedness cut off from the branches outside, if it is kept at the root within, to spring up in more manifold ways. Whence also the truth in person says, Love your enemies, do good to them who hate you, and pray for them who persecute you and say evil of you falsely. It is virtue, therefore, before men, to bear with adversaries, but it is virtue before God to love them. Because the only sacrifice which God accepts is that which before his eyes, on the altar of good work, the flame of charity kindles. Hence it is that to some who were patient and yet did not love, he says, And why do you see the mote in your brother's eye and do not see the beam in your own eye? For indeed, the perturbation of impatience is a mote, but malice in the heart is like a beam in the eye. For that the breeze of temptation drives to and fro, but this confirmed iniquity carries almost immovably. Rightly, however, it is there subjoined, You hypocrite, first cast out the beam out of your own eye, and then you will see to cast out the mote from your brother's eye. As if it were said to the wicked mind, inwardly grieving while showing itself by patience, outwardly as holy, First shake off from you the weight of malice, and then blame others for the levity of impatience, lest, while you take no pains to conquer pretense, it be worse for you to bear with the faultiness of others. For it usually comes to pass with the patient, that at the time, indeed, when they suffer hardships or hear insults, they are smitten with no vexation, and so exhibit patience, as to fail not to keep also innocence of heart. But when after a while they recall to memory these very same things that they have endured, they inflame themselves with the fire of vexation. They seek reasons for vengeance, and in retracting turn into malice the meekness they had in bearing. Such are the sooner succored by the preacher, if the cause of this change be disclosed. For the cunning adversary wages war against two. That is, by inflaming one to be the first to offer insults, and provoking the other to return insults, under a sense of injury. But, for the most part, while he is already conqueror of him who has been persuaded to inflict the injury, he is conquered by him who bears the infliction with an equal mind. Wherefore, being victorious over the one whom he has subjugated by incensing him, he lifts himself with all his might against the other, and is grieved at his firmly resisting and conquering. And so, because he has been unable to move him in the very flinging of insults, he rests meanwhile from open contest, and, provoking his thoughts by secret suggestion, seeks a fit time for deceiving him. For having lost in public warfare, he burns to lay hidden snares. In a time of quiet, he returns to the mind of the conqueror, brings back to his memory either temporal harms or the darts of insults, and, by exceedingly exaggerating all that has been inflicted on him, represents it as intolerable. And with so great vexation does he perturb the mind, that for the most part the patient one, led captive after victory, blushes for having borne such things calmly, and is sorry that he did not return insults, and seeks to pay back something worse, should opportunity be afforded. To whom, then, are these like, but to those who by bravery are victorious in the field, but by negligence are afterwards taken within the gates of the city? To whom are they like, but to those whom a violent attack of sickness removes not from life, but who die from a relapse of fever coming gently on? Wherefore, the patient are to be admonished that they guard their heart after victory, that they be on the lookout for the enemy, overcome in open warfare, laying snares against the walls of their mind, that they be the more afraid of a sickness creeping on again, lest the cunning enemy, should he afterwards deceive them, rejoice with greater exultation, in that he treads on the necks of conquerors which had long been inflexible against him. End of chapter 9. Pastoral Care by St. Gregory the Great. Chapter 10. How the Kindly Disposed and the Envious Are to be Admonished. Differently to be admonished are the kindly disposed and the envious. For the kindly disposed are to be admonished so to rejoice in what is good in others, as to desire to have the like as their own. So to praise with affection the deeds of their neighbors, as also to multiply them by imitation, lest in this stadium of the present life they assist at the contest of others as eager backers, but inert spectators, and remain without a prize after the contest, in that they toiled not in the contest, and should then regard with sorrow the palms of those in the midst of whose toils they stood idle. For indeed, we sin greatly if we love not the good deeds of others, but we win no reward if we imitate not, so far as we can, the things which we love. Wherefore the kindly disposed should be told that if they make no haste to imitate the good that they applaud, the holiness of virtue pleases them in like manner as the vanity of scenic exhibitions of skill pleases foolish spectators. For these extol with applause the performances of charioteers and players, yet do not long to be such as they see those whom they praise to be. They admire them for having done pleasing things, and yet they shun pleasing in a like manner. The kindly disposed are to be told that when they behold the deeds of their neighbors, they should return to their own hearts, and presume not on actions which are not their own, nor praise what is good while refusing to do it. More heavily indeed must those be struck by final vengeance who have been pleased by that which they would not imitate. The envious are to be admonished how great is their blindness, who fail by other men's advancement, and pine away at other men's rejoicing. How great is their unhappiness, who are made worse by the bettering of their neighbor, and in beholding the increase of another's prosperity, are uneasily vexed within themselves, and die of the plague of their own heart. What can be more unhappy than these who, when touched by the sight of happiness, are made more wicked by the pain of seeing it? But moreover, the good things of others which they cannot have, they might, if they loved them, make their own. For indeed, all are constituted together in faith, as are many members in one body, which are indeed diverse as to their office, but in mutually agreeing with each other are made one. Whence it comes to pass that the foot sees by the eye, and the eyes walk by the feet, that the hearing of the ears serves the mouth, and the tongue of the mouth concurs with the ears for their benefit, that the belly supports the hands, and the hands work for the belly. In the very arrangement of the body, therefore, we learn what we should observe in our conduct. It is, then, too shameful not to act up to what we are. Those things, in fact, are ours which we love in others, even though we cannot follow them. And what things are loved in us become theirs that love them. Hence, then, let the envious consider of how great power is love, which makes ours, without labor, works of labor not our own. The envious are therefore to be told that when they fail to keep themselves from spite, they are sunk into the old wickedness of the wily foe. For of him it is written, "But by envy of the devil, death entered into the world." For because he had himself lost heaven, he envied it to created man, and being himself ruined by ruining others, he heaped up his own damnation. The envious are to be admonished, that they may learn to how great slips of ruin growing under them they are liable, since while they cast not forth spite out of their heart, they are slipping down to open wickedness of deeds. For unless Cain had envied the accepted sacrifice of his brother, he would never have come to taking away his life. Whence it is written, And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his face fell. Thus spite on account of the sacrifice was the seed plot of fratricide. For him, whose being better than himself vexed him, he cut off from being at all. The envious are to be told that while they consume themselves with this inward plague, they destroy whatever good they seem to have within them. Whence it is written, Soundness of heart is the life of the flesh, but envy the rottenness of the bones. For what is signified by the flesh but certain weak and tender actions? And what by the bones but brave ones? And for the most part it comes to pass that some, with innocence of heart, in some of their actions seem weak, but others, though performing some stout deeds before human eyes, still pine away inwardly with the pestilence of envy towards what is good in others. Wherefore it is well said, Soundness of heart is the life of the flesh. Because if innocence of mind is kept, even such things as are weak outwardly are in time strengthened. And rightly it is there added, Envy is the rottenness of the bones. Because through the vice of spite, what seems strong to human eyes perishes in the eyes of God. For the rotting of the bones through envy means that certain, even strong things utterly perish. Chapter 11. How the Simple and the Crafty Are to Be Admonished. Differently to be admonished are the simple and the insincere. The simple are to be praised for studying never to say what is false, but to be admonished to know sometimes to be silent about what is true. For as falsehood has always harmed him that speaks it, so sometimes the hearing of truth has done harm to some. Wherefore the Lord, before his disciples, tempering his speech with silence, says, I have many things to say unto you, but you cannot bear them now. The simple are, therefore, to be admonished that as they always avoid deceit advantageously, so they should always utter truth advantageously. They are to be admonished to add prudence to the goodness of simplicity, to the end that they may so possess the security of simplicity as not to lose the circumspection of prudence. For hence it is said by the teacher of the Gentiles, I would have you wise in that which is good, but simple concerning evil. Hence, the truth in person admonishes his elect, saying, Be ye wise as serpents, but simple as doves. Because, to wit, in the hearts of the elect, the wisdom of the serpent ought to sharpen the simplicity of the dove, and the simplicity of the dove temper the wisdom of the serpent, to the end that neither through prudence they be seduced into cunning, nor from simplicity grow torpid in the exercise of the understanding. But on the other hand, the insincere are to be admonished to learn how heavy is the labor of duplicity, which with guilt they endure. For while they are afraid of being found out, they are ever seeking dishonest defenses. They are agitated by fearful suspicions. But there is nothing safer for defense than sincerity, nothing easier to say than truth. For when obliged to defend its deceit, the heart is wearied with hard labor. For hence it is written, The labor of their own lips shall cover them. For what now fills them then covers them, since it then presses down with sharp retribution him whose soul it now elevates with a mild disquietude. Hence it is said through Jeremiah, "They have taught their tongue to speak lies, and to weary themselves to commit iniquity." As if it were said plainly, "They who might have been friends of truth without labor, labor to sin, and while they refuse to live in simplicity, by labors require that they should die." For commonly, when taken in a fault, while they shrink from being known to be such as they are, they hide themselves under a veil of deceit, and endeavor to excuse their sin, which is already plainly perceived. So that often one who has a care to reprove their faults, led astray by the mists of the falsehood that surrounds them, finds himself to have almost lost what he just now held as certain concerning them. Hence it is rightly said through the prophet, under the similitude of Judah, to the soul that sins and excuses itself, "There the urchin had her nest." For by the name of urchin is denoted the duplicity of a mind that is insincere and cunningly defends itself. For when a urchin is caught, its head is perceived and its feet appear, and its whole body is exposed to view. But no sooner has the porcupine been caught than it gathers itself into a ball, draws in its feet, hides its head, and all is lost together within the hands of him that holds it, which before was visible altogether. So assuredly, so insincere minds are when they are seized hold of in their transgressions. For the head of the hedgehog is perceived because it appears from what beginning the sinner has advanced to his crime. The feet of the urchin are seen because it is discovered by what steps the iniquity has been perpetrated. And yet, by suddenly adducing excuses, the insincere mind gathers in its feet, in that it hides all traces of its iniquity. It draws in the head, because by strange defenses it makes out that it has not even begun any evil. And it remains, as it were, a ball in the hand of the one who holds it, because one that takes it to task, suddenly losing all that he had just now come to the knowledge of, holds the sinner rolled up within his own consciousness. And though he had seen the whole of him when he was caught, yet, eluded by the tergiversation of dishonest defense, he is in like measure ignorant of the whole of him. Thus, the urchin has her nest in the reprobate, because the duplicity of a crafty mind, gathering itself up within itself, hides itself in the darkness of its self-defense. Let the insincere hear what is written: "He that walks in simplicity walks surely." For indeed, simplicity of conduct is an assurance of great security. Let them hear what is said by the mouth of the wise man: "The Holy Spirit of discipline will flee deceit." Let them hear what is again affirmed by the witness of Scripture: "His communion is with the simple." For God's communion is his revealing of secrets to human minds by the illumination of his presence. He is therefore said to commune with the simple, because he illuminates with the ray of his visitation concerning supernal mysteries the minds of those whom no shade of duplicity obscures. But it is a special evil of the double-minded that while they deceive others by their crooked and double conduct, they glory as though they were surpassingly prudent beyond others. And since they consider not the strictness of retribution, they exult, miserable men that they are, in their own losses. But let them hear how the prophet Zephaniah holds out over them the power of divine rebuke, saying, "Behold, the day of the Lord comes, great and horrible, the day of wrath that day. A day of darkness and gloominess, a day of cloud and whirlwind, a day of trumpet and clangor upon all fenced cities and upon all lofty corners." For what is expressed by fenced cities
but mind suspected and surrounded ever with a fallacious defense. Minds which, as often as their fault is attacked, suffer not the darts of truth to reach them. And what is signified by lofty corners, a wall being always double in corners, but insincere hearts, which, while they shun the simplicity of truth, are in a manner doubled back upon themselves in the crookedness of duplicity. And what is worse, from their very fault of insincerity, lift themselves in their thoughts with the pride of prudence. Therefore, the day of the Lord comes, full of vengeance and rebuke, upon fenced cities and lofty corners, because the wrath of the last judgment both destroys human hearts that have been closed by defenses against the truth, and unfolds such as have been folded up in duplicities. For then the fenced cities fall, because souls which God has not penetrated will be damned. Then the lofty corners tumble, because hearts which erect themselves in the prudence of insincerity are prostrated by the sentence of righteousness. End of chapter 11.